Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Fiction Predictions from Mashable.
I'm Sam Haysom.
And I'm Nikolai Nikolov.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, well, I mean, I know we're only a few episodes in, but you boldly, in episode 2, for your Panopticon prediction, described it as the perfect fiction prediction, didn't you?
I did.
Okay, well, I'm gonna make a pretty big claim at the start of this episode. I'm going to go out on a limb and I'm going to say the novella I want to talk about today is the most eerily accurate example of a book predicting a real life event that I think I've ever come across, at least so far in this podcast.
I think that's a very good clarification. It's crazy, right? Because when we came up with this idea of fiction predictions, you know, we had the big sort of books and TV shows and movies in our head. But like the more people we talk to and the more feedback we get, there's some incredible gems out there, aren't there?
It is. And the really nice thing is that whenever I've mentioned fiction predictions to anyone, they've normally had an example or two that's popped into their head straight away. And this is actually very similar to how I came across this one.
Okay.
So I was basically speaking to my friend Dave.
Okay, I'm recording you now. For the purpose of the podcast, it's probably better if you're not chewing.
I've finished chewing, sorry.
He's also a doctor, incidentally.
My name's David Spittle.
But I was speaking to him about... God, I've got two friends that are doctors. Three, actually. One of them's a real doctor.
You're not a real
doctor. Not saying you're not a real doctor.
Well, he did his PhD in poetry or something interesting like this, right?
I'm a poet. I've got my first book came out last year, and that was called Box, and it was a sort of exploration of memory, past and present. And I just got very into this idea of containment and collecting, and how that may or may not relate to how we coordinate memory.
And I was chatting to him about fiction predictions, and he mentioned to me a book. Well, it was later on, a week or so after I spoke to him about it. He sent me a message.
Yeah, I was but a wee lad. I was very young. I guess I was probably about 9 or 10, maybe.
Basically, he'd found a book in, I think he said he was just an old book in a charity shop.
And it was at a delightfully rural village fate sort of thing. Think Midsummer Murders meets, meets something else equally rural and quaint.
And it had a little section on it. I think it was like an academic book or something to do with philosophy or something, maybe.
I think it caught my eye at that age because it looked like the perfect mixture of adult. So I was like, oh, if I read this, I'm going to be an absolute authority on the ocean, because it's called the Ocean Almanac.
So that was the kind of genesis of where this idea came from. So it wasn't one of mine. My friend Dave gave it to me.
Being a copious compendium on sea creatures, nautical lore and legend, master mariners, naval disasters, and myriad mysteries of the deep. That's on the front cover. Informative. Yeah, no, and also, you know, alliteration as well. So it's got everything going on. It's by Robert Hendrickson.
And it had a little section in it, and it referenced this novella, which I'm going to talk to you about today.
I recently just moved, and it kind of got unearthed in the move, and decided in a moment of anti-screen irritation with my phone and scrolling. So yeah, I was just browsing and then found that little factoid about the Titanic, and thought that is relevant.
Yeah, I was kind of blown away, actually, by how accurate this novella is. So, shall I tell you what it is?
I'm really excited to hear it.
Okay. So, the story I want to talk about today is called Futility, The Wreck of the Titan, and it's a novella by Morgan Robertson. And this story is about a fictional ocean liner called the Titan, which sinks after hitting an iceberg. And here's the thing, it was published in 1898, which is 14 years before the sinking of the Titanic.
Well done, Dave.
Yeah, it's really a pretty wild...
So what's the ship called?
Okay. So the ship is called the Titan. What I wanted to start with, first of all, really, is just a description of this ship. The ship in Morgan Robertson's story, because when you compare the Titan with the Titanic, the similarities immediately start to stack up. So this was, 14 years before the Titanic sank. So first of all, like you said, you've got the names Titan versus Titanic. Second of all, you've got the descriptions. The first line of Robertson's novella reads, "She was the largest craft afloat." And various descriptions of the Titanic and the Olympic, its sort of twin ship, the way they were described in adverts, they were both called the largest steamers in the world.
"I don't see what all the fuss is about. It doesn't look any bigger than the Mauritania."
"You could be blasé about some things, Rose, but not about Titanic. It's over 100 feet longer than Mauritania, and far more luxurious."
So then you've got the size. 800 foot for the Titan, 882.5 feet for the Titanic. Very similar again. Then you've got the speed. Speaking about the Titan, Robertson writes, "On her trial trip, had steamed at a rate of 25 knots an hour over the bottom. The Titanic, meanwhile, I believe was travelling at 22.5 knots when it hit the iceberg." So you've already got these two ships. One of them completely fictional, written over a decade before the other one was conceived. And they're really, really similar. And it just gets more and more strange from there, really.
So far, it's kind of like, okay, they're similar. But, I mean, if the Titanic was the biggest ship, and this person who presumably knew something about ships, this guy...
He did. Yeah, he was very knowledgeable about this kind of maritime world.
Okay, so he must have known, like, what kind of ship they were maybe trying to build before the actual Titanic was built, but... Is that all? Is that where you're...
No, it's not all. First of all, it's worth pointing out as well that just in case you were sort of thinking early on, well, you know, maybe it's not that far before the Titanic. Maybe he got wind that they were building the Titanic and sort of, you know, created a quick fictional example of it. He wouldn't have known. I dug into this a little bit, and it's the Titanic, although it launched...
1912?
So I can't remember if it may have launched 1911, but so it sank 1912, but construction didn't start until 1909. So that was Robertson's novella had already been in print for 11 years at that point.
Okay.
But anyway, we'll come back to that point later, because I do think there is something in that, despite the fact he couldn't have known about that specific ship.
Okay, go on.
So the second part after the descriptions of the ship is safety. The Titan is described in quite extensive detail at the opening of Futility, and Robertson writes, "With 9 compartments flooded, the ship would still float, and so no known accident of the sea could possibly fill this many. The steamship Titan was considered practically unsinkable." So, first of all, you've got this idea that it's this giant ship, nothing's going to sink it. Robertson also writes about how if there were other craft that were in the ocean, they'd be expected to get out of its way. You know, there was this idea that it was basically almost indestructible.
"So this is the ship they say is unsinkable."
"It is unsinkable. Sir. God himself could not sink this ship. What?"
Philip Franklin, who was the vice president of White Star Line, so that's the shipping company behind the Titanic, going back to real life now, he's quoted as describing the ship as unsinkable when he first sort of got wind, when the news was starting to break. Because obviously back when the Titanic sank, it wasn't like it would be today where we all see videos and find out immediately what's happening. The news kind of filtered slowly. So when he first heard that there'd been some kind of accident, he's quoted as saying, "There is no danger that Titanic will sink. The boat is unsinkable and nothing but inconvenience will be suffered by the passengers."
And that's the entire sort of premise of the Titanic when they were trying to get all these kinds of people on the boat. Some of the first class tickets were thousands and thousands of dollars. And the way that they were advertising it, is that it's like the unsinkable, well, allegedly, right? But it was the unsinkable boat.
Big boat, huh?
Daddy, it's a ship.
You're right.
Whenever you read an article about the Titanic, it is described as unsinkable.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of sort of discrepancy over where this idea came from. Like, I think it was sort of disputed, like the Harland and Wolff, who built the ship, they said that they didn't describe it as unsinkable. And then some people said it was described as practically unsinkable. And then others were sort of saying that the media, there were a couple of articles that described it this way, and then the media kind of latched onto the term. Mm. Obviously, no one wants to have the responsibility of saying it was an unsinkable ship,
right,
when obviously it did sink. But for whatever reason, the legacy of the Titanic is this idea of an unsinkable ship. And the Titan, this fictional boat, was exactly the same.
Right, go on. I'll get the next one.
No.
So, jumping back to Robertson's fictional ship, the Titan.
I'll be all right. Listen, I'll be fine. I'm a survivor, all right?
It almost seems, when you read the book,
see? Got my own boat to catch.
Like, its doom is kind of, it's almost foreshadowed by this certainty that it won't sink.
Step aboard, miss!
Go.
Come on, hurry!
Step aboard, please!
Daddy's good girl, all right?
Step lively!
You're my little sailor!
Keep back! Keep back, I say!
My tears are pouring down. There isn't any water.
And yeah, just talking about the lifeboats again, there's another quote from Robertson's book here. Indestructible, she carried as few boats as would satisfy the laws. These, 24 in number, were securely covered and lashed down to their chocks on the upper deck, and if launched, would hold 500 people. Okay, 500 people. So all the lifeboats on the Titan, if they launch, they're going to hold 500. There are 3,000 berths on the Titan. So the lifeboats were capable of rescuing basically about 17% of the passengers, assuming the ship was full.
Right.
The Titanic, meanwhile, had 20 lifeboats, capable, if full, of carrying 1,178 people. The Titanic has a maximum capacity of around 3,500 people. So again, another similarity to the Titan. But on its voyage, there were, I think, around 2,200 on board when it sank.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even with 2,200, if the lifeboats had been filled completely, there would still only have been enough room for just over half the passengers. So
that's absolutely insane.
Yeah, it is. And it's it's obviously it's sort of sad to think about, but when you think of Robertson's writing, it's those similarities, even in those numbers and this this idea of unsinkable and the way it was kind of marketed to people is really, really similar again.
I guess is this approach to this, you know, incredible human feat of engineering, that they've built this machine that will never sink. Like, we don't need to make provisions for the worst because the worst is never going to happen.
Well, that's a good point, actually. Like, you know, Titan is almost like, yeah, the whole idea is almost kind of mythical sounding, isn't it? And meant to be impressive. And Robertson was writing this as a story, essentially. So he wanted the most impressive ship. But of course, in real life, you know, people want to weave their own, like, narratives around things that are real and create this legendary kind of status. Next, I wanted to talk about the sinking itself. And it sinks, again, you know, and this is when I was reading it, I couldn't believe it, in pretty much exactly the same sort of way as the Titanic.
Oh, come on.
It hits an iceberg.
It hits an iceberg?
Yeah.
You're telling me that you read a book that your friend Dave found
Why
in an old
Why did you say
bookstore.
Dave's name so disparagingly? Sorry, know, Dave. He didn't mean that.
The more you're talking about this, the less authentic this seems to be. So you're saying that your PhD friend Dave found this book called The Titan in an old bookstore, called you up, and you just like magically brought this after I brought the house down with the Panopticon. Now you bring this.
After I brought the house down.
Is this even a real book?
I wonder if anyone's ever uttered the sentence before I brought the house down with a Panopticon before.
Well, you're just trying to change.
You think I'm trying to one-up you. It does sound...
It sounds made up. Yeah, it does.
No, but this is the thing. So
you're saying that The Titan, which was written, like, whatever, 14 years before the Titanic,
mm-hmm.
that almost sounds exactly the same
yeah,
as
similar
Titanic.
Specifications.
Yeah. Biggest boat ever.
Described the same way. And
hits
then
hits an iceberg and sinks.
Yeah. So I'll just read you another quote from the book, and this is the moment when they make contact with the iceberg.
Is there anyone there?
Yes, what do you see?
Ice, iceberg. Yelled the lookout. Right ice ahead. Ahead! Iceberg, right under the bows.
Iceberg, right ahead!
The first officer ran amidships, and the captain, who had remained there, sprang to the engine room telegraph, and this time the lever was turned. But in 5 seconds, the bow of the Titan began to lift, and ahead, and on either hand, could be seen, through the fog, a field of ice.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Which rose in an incline to 100 feet high in her track.
It's gonna hit!
I just keep coming back to that moment when the ice strikes, and particularly that quote that you had where that man is screaming ice.
Mm.
It's just so almost gut-wrenching, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And
I wonder what it sounded like.
There's a lot of description about that passage, and I'll read some of the quote again. Amid the roar of escaping steam and the bee-like buzzing of nearly 3,000 human voices, raised in agonized screams and callings from within the enclosing walls, and the whistling of air through hundreds of open deadlights as the water, entering the holes of the crushed and riven starboard side, expelled it, the Titan moved slowly backward and launched herself into the sea, where she floated low on her side, a dying monster groaning with her death wound. Yeah, pretty kind of dark kind of description that follows that that line about them spotting the iceberg. One of the lines that really stood out to me, as I was preparing for the podcast, I watched some video interviews with the survivors. I read a few articles and interviews with them. And there's one book called A Night to Remember by a man called Walter Lord.
Yeah, I know that book.
Yeah, so he's a real authority on the Titanic and what happened.
Yeah.
And he'd interviewed a man called Jack Thayer. And he was a teenager picked out by one of the lifeboats. And he, in this interview, he recalls the sound that was made by hundreds of people sort of flailing in the water. And he described it as the noise of locusts buzzing in the Pennsylvania countryside on a summer night.
Wow.
That description, you know, that horrible description of all these voices raised and it being like an insect buzz. And an actual survivor describing it in that way.
I think the insect comparison is just so powerful because it's this sense of absolute futility of humans, right? It's at the face of nature, we're just completely and utterly powerless.
I guess that's what makes it a fascinating story.
But it's also, I mean, I just can't stop thinking about this tiny book. How many pages is it? It's like 50 pages.
Yeah, it's about 50.
It's a tiny little book talking about the biggest ship ever. And all it took to describe this just magnitudinal catastrophe of modern humanity was 54 pages.
Oh, yeah. And on that note, well, okay, I should ask you on that note,
Yeah, it's a good
you
fiction prediction.
You need to see. It's a good fiction prediction. You know, it's a good fiction prediction.
I mean, you can't. Like, no person in their right mind would say this is a bad fiction prediction. We challenge anyone listening to this to give counter arguments as to why this doesn't really work, because this is kind of blew my mind.
It's pretty mind blowing.
I was wondering why you're so secretive while you were preparing for this.
It's pretty mind blowing, and I'd in my head, I'm thinking it's going to take a lot for another prediction, just one little book or one little TV show or whatever it is to come along that blows my mind more.
Do you know what? I want to build upon it. Is that all right? I have another aspect where I think the Titan really works very well.
Okay.
You ready?
Oh, go on then.
Potentially this is predictable in itself, but I'm going to try to give it a little bit of a historical / philosophical twist.
Of course, I was waiting for the philosophical.
Well, I mean, I think every historical reference that we had so far definitely has some sort of impact on the present, and I think the Titanic-Titan duo is particularly diagnostic of the world that we live in today.
Yes, no, absolutely. I'm interested to hear where you're going with this.
We're already facing the consequences of climate change. We ourselves are, in a way, this Titanic ship headed towards the iceberg, right? It's like an impending doom where our technological advances, without considering the consequences, we're heading down this road.
So I see where you're going. So you're saying if you're using the Titanic or the Titan, Robertson's Titan, as a kind of metaphor for, say, climate change in the modern day, then... Yeah, there's particularly in the Titanic, actually, isn't it? Because
stickler for the rules, I guess you are. You're not even going to acknowledge my historical sort of allegory just because it's more related to the Titanic than the Titan.
Oh yeah, well that is true. I mean, technically, it's a very good point, but I don't know if it's an extra fiction prediction.
I tried. Right, guys, so because I couldn't convince Sam on my own after we first recorded the podcast, I went out and tried to find someone who could.
No, I'm sorry. It's just been, I've been traveling a lot and I just lost the thread. Anyway, fire away.
I was totally convinced that there was so much more to this fiction prediction than just the eerily accurate comparisons between the Titan and Titanic.
Yeah, sure.
I felt like it was nothing less than a metaphor for who we are as modern human beings.
That's great, thank you.
So... I called Daniel Mendelsohn.
Yeah, I'm Daniel Mendelsohn. I'm a writer and a critic. I write mostly for the New York Review of Books, where I'm an editor, and the New Yorker magazine.
And Daniel wrote this incredible article for the New Yorker on the centenary of the sinking of the Titanic. And so I decided to bring him on the show to try and help convince Sam of the prescience, really, of this ship.
At the end of this long essay I wrote for the New Yorker for the centenary of the sinking of the Titanic in 2012, I referred, as Titanic enthusiasts often do, to this 1898 novel by an American writer called Morgan Wright Robertson. And the title, Futility, sort of nods to the, what I would say, the Greek DNA of the whole disaster, which is about hubris, right? That the works of man are nothing compared to nature. And that was the point of this novel, which was written in 1898, 14 years before the Titanic sank. So there's a
prophecy almost. It's like a Greek tragedy, essentially.
The reason that the Titanic disaster captures our imagination is because it is essentially mythic. It replays in real life a mythic theme, which is, or several actually, which is about man against nature.
It's a story about class. It's a story about race. It's a story about struggle. It's almost...
It is a perfect symbol of certain themes. They're literary themes, and in a way, they're religious themes. You know, you shouldn't get too big for your britches, right? It's about hubris. There's a great story about how one of the Titanic's sister ships, which ended up being called the Britannic, was originally supposed to be called the Gigantic, but after the Titanic sank, the board of the White Star Line apparently felt that they were taking this size thing a little too far, and they had to calm it down, so they gave it a more tame name. But, you know, that speaks to something that we feel to be true, which is that there's a place that mankind occupies in the universe that we shouldn't go beyond, right? And the Titanic story seems to emblematize that theme, which is also a theme of Greek myth. It's a way of saying that if the real-life Titanic hadn't existed, we would have almost had to invent it, which, in fact, this American novelist did 14 years before the Titanic set sail in real life.
It's however many years now since the Titanic sunk. And over this time, there has been countless songs, poems, articles, books, obviously movies, just been consistently fascinated with this story. And it's not necessarily just because, you know, it was the biggest ship at the time. It was an unexpected and obviously tragic event. It's something more, you know, James Cameron's film.
Were to make a movie now, I'm sure there would be a sort of environmental twist, right? Because you can do it. It's about
class,
man and his notion of progress,
about love and romance.
So I think that's the whole point of a certain kind of story seems always to be useful to be about whatever it needs to be about. And in fact, in my article about the Titanic centenary, I mentioned some of the recent academic scholarship about the Titanic and how each generation since 1912 has seen in the disaster what it needs to see.
So what did you think of that?
Yes, that was fascinating, actually. I stumbled across Daniel's article at some point when I was researching the podcast, but hearing him speaking about it is really interesting. And I think particularly, yeah, just the way he characterizes the whole thing and almost that inevitability to someone writing a story like that, given, you know, where it felt like the human race was headed. I think that's a really important point. And I think it perhaps ties into what we were discussing earlier about, you know, Morgan Robertson. On the one hand, he wrote a very, very impressively accurate prediction. But, you know, on the other hand, when you really start to diagnose it, was it that surprising that he wrote that story, given the trends that he was obviously observing? And I don't just mean the naval trends necessarily. I mean this trend of constantly trying to go one bigger and better.
I mean, it's like Daniel said, it seems to be these generation-defining moments seem to be almost cyclical.
Basically, what I'm saying is we turn to literature precisely because it illuminates our condition, even if it's old. Human nature has never changed, and the problems that we confront, the basic problems that we confront, are not different. The gadgets have gotten better, but we remain the same.
There's a reason that you get folk tales and stories that just repeat throughout history, and that's because they sum up the very basic elements of human nature. And
yeah, so I know you were skeptical at first, but aren't you glad that I got Daniel on the phone?
No, I'm really glad. I wasn't skeptical at all, but I was just, I guess because I've been really closely looking at the book and all the sort of close parallels with the real world event, it was really interesting that you brought in this wider context and how it really kind of ties everything very interestingly together, I think, because it's not just really, when we look at something on a bigger scale, it's not just an example of that, oh, he really smartly wrote this book that predicted something. It's actually, well, there's patterns behind everything. And there's a reason he was able to do it.
I guess you can say the pattern that we've developed at this podcast is that you tend to focus on sort of the literature side of things, on the actual texts and words, and I try to like dig out sort of some historical.
You dig out the deeper, more impressive stuff. I see what you're trying to say. You say I sort of cover the very surface level, the dumbed down version, if you will.
I mean, it's just like an iceberg. You're the part of the iceberg that you could see.
See, this is why we need to have you on here. It's just that kind of that analysis combined with that razor sharp.
But it's also that we thankfully we had two friends to help us out this week.
Yes, that definitely helps because you know it's always good. The more people you have, the more things you tend to spot, I think.
Yeah, special thanks to Daniel.
No, I think this has been a lot of fun.
And Dave for
that's
coming on the pod this week.
Okay.
Yes, thank you very much for coming on, guys.
So next week, we're very excited. We got another very special guest.
Yes. Speaking of having people on the podcast, we have Marcus Gilmer, who's a reporter for Mashable, coming on next week. And he's going to be talking about, well, I don't know how much we should give away, but he's talking about a certain famous family, an American family, and tying it to American politics.
That's very vague.
is that too vague or not vague enough?
No, it's pretty good. I'll just add that it's an animated family.
Okay.
And it's known to make what we have deemed spookily accurate predictions.
Yes,
about
that
the
is
real world.
That is for sure.
Anyway, super excited. Marcus is a great guy, and he wrote an article about it for Mashable. So, you know, as always, guys, stick around. Thanks for listening, and definitely leave us a comment or a rating if you haven't already. And please let us know of any fiction predictions you want us to consider.
Yeah, and check us out on Twitter. It's at Sam Hasem, at Nikolai_Nikolov, and at predictions_pod. That's the podcast's handle.
All right, guys. Bye.
All right, bye.
Fiction predictions.
Fiction Predictions is a Mashable podcast created by Nikolai Nikolov and Sam Hasem. The theme song was composed by Kasberg. The artwork was designed by Bob Algarine, and this episode was edited by me.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.